Al Cain, therefore, Husama Adnam Bazeh Olam Atchila, man was placed into this world at first, Kidei in order, Shaideh Haemtzayim Ha'ele, so that via these mediums, Hamizdamnim Lokan, that occurred to him here, Yuchal Hagia, he can get to, Elamokam Ashehuchan Lo, to the place that has been prepared for him, Shehu Ha'olam Abba, which is the world to come. Lirva Sham Betuv, to enjoy there the good, Ashekana Lo, that he acquired, Al Yidei Hamtzayim Ela, via these mediums. Vumash Amru Zichon Levracha, and this is what Chazal have taught us, Hayom La'asosam, today is to do them, Umachar, and tomorrow, Lekabel Scharam, tomorrow is to gather the reward. I was a high school Rebbe for many years, and part of the job of a high school Rebbe is to teach Tosas, and part of the job of a Rebbe is to teach life, to understand life. Now these were all boys from homes, well-educated, but I recognized quickly on that there were huge gaps in their understanding. So every year when I would introduce the Musar part of the curriculum, I would typically begin with the following type of question. I would look at these guys and I would say, gentlemen, tell me, why don't you sin? Why don't you sin? But I don't mean little sins, I mean big deal stuff, go out there, murder, kill every imaginable avera you've ever thought of. So typically, the guys would say, well, Hashem will be angry with me. I don't want Hashem to be angry with me. I look at these guys and say, gentlemen, listen to me. Throughout the millennium, many Rishayim, many wicked people have flourished. Don't you go worry about God. At which point, at least one of the guys would say, yeah, that's true now, but my neshama is going to burn. I don't want my soul to burn. At which point, again, I would look at the guys and I would say, tell me, you mean to say that there are many things that you do and many things that you don't do merely so your neshama should have a good time there? You listen to me. You do exactly what you want. You party, you sin, do whatever you want. Why should you work so hard so your neshama should have a good time in the world to come? You take care of you and let your neshama burn. Now, when I said that, I would stand at the front of the room. No one was allowed to leave before they heard the answer. I don't want to hear it. 20 years later, a guy becomes a serial killer, Rabbi Schaefer said. But what is the answer? What is the answer to that question? So Rabbi Yisrael Salanta explains to us that we make a fundamental mistake. We assume that death is vastly different than now, as in now I'm alive, but then I'll be dead, dark, black, who even knows, I'll be dead. Says Rabbi Yisrael Salanta, that's a fundamental error. If you'd like to understand death, all you have to understand is the following mashal. Imagine I come into the room. Imagine that I hang my coat up outside and I walk into the room. I've entered, my coat remains out there. Says Rabbi Yisrael Salanta, that is death. The body is the coat. The body's put in the ground, but I separate. I, the one who tell my arms and legs to move. I, the one who thinks. I, the one who remembers. I, the guy inside, lives on forever. This part, the body, is the coat. The body is buried, but I leave. I'm like that astronaut who wears a spacesuit, but it's put in the ground, and then I separate. But you see, this understanding is very different than the way most people think about death. Most people think about death as, well, I don't know, I'll be dead, maybe my alter ego, my distant cousin, some splintered version of me will be there, but I'll be dead, safely dead. Says Rabbi Yisrael Salanta, you're making a critical error. It's I with all of my thoughts, all of my feelings. It's not my distant cousin. It's not some alter ego. It's me. The body is buried, but with the same acute alertness, with the same actual consciousness, I live on forever. The body is buried, and I'm not it. But you see, we're very comfortable with our current existence. We're very comfortable in this body, and we begin to forget, and we begin to think of ourselves as the body. And usually most people, when they think about death, have this sort of skewed version. Matter of fact, if you go to a Beis HaKvaros, if you go to the cemetery, you'll often see the words at rest, rest in peace. As in, Harvey was a good man, now he's in his final resting peace place. If you ask most people to define death, it's kind of like going to sleep. And that is a critical mistake. You see, when I go to sleep, I'm not there. Let me give you a mashal. Imagine you break your arm. and you're in terrible pain, throbbing pain, nothing helps. You try Tylenol, Tylenol with codeine, nothing stops it. Finally, 3 a.m., Baruch Hashem, I fall asleep, I'm not there. My arm doesn't bother me because I'm not present. Most people think about death as in going to sleep, as in I won't be there. If that were true, the question I ask these guys is 100% relevant. Who cares about Olam Haba? Who cares if this world is a gym and the world to come is a spa? I won't be there. I'll be asleep. I'll be at rest. My neshama, my distant cousin, my alter ego, whatever that is, will be there. But I'll be at rest. I'll be asleep. So it doesn't matter. Says Rabbi Sol Solanta, you're making one mistake. I am the neshama. I am the occupant of this body. I'm the guy inside. I'm the one who tells the arms and legs to move. The arms and legs is the shell. That's the coat. It's put in the ground and I separate with all of my feelings, with all of my memories. It's me and it's forever. And that understanding is critical to understanding what it means that I'll be in Olam Haba. It's critical to understanding life, but it's a bit elusive. And it's not so simple to feel, to be margish, to actually feel it in a very real way. Let me give you an example. Let's say someone punches me. Ouch! Well, why'd you punch me? Now, we don't think of it in those terms, but automatically, if you punch my arm, I feel as if you punched me, and usually that's an accurate enough understanding. Why'd you punch me? Why'd you kick me? Why'd you cause me pain? But if we were really, really careful in our definition, I would say, why did you punch the arm of the body that I currently occupy? Now, we don't need to think that way because in the normal traffic of life, it's irrelevant, but that conscious separation is critical because one of the biggest mistakes we make is we confuse I for the body, as in I'm this body. I've always been here. Every day of my life, I've opened my eyes and this body's always been there. So I guess this is me. I'm it and it's me and it's there forever. And if that were true, death makes no sense. Death is not understandable. Well, what do you mean? I'll be dead and I'll be alive and the body's dead and I'm alive. Well, I'm the body and the body's me and the whole thing makes no sense. The ability to separate, to understand that I'm the guy inside, I'm the occupant of the body, I currently wear this shell, but the shell will be buried in the ground like a coat that's put on the hook, is critical for understanding death and critical to understanding actually who I am. One of the biggest problems that we have is self-awareness. Self-awareness means being able to define my feelings, being able to define what motivates me, but self-awareness requires, before anything, being aware of what I am, who I am. Being self-aware means recognizing that I am the guy inside. And I'd like to share with you an obvious example, but it's worth doing. Let's imagine the following. Imagine it's a Sunday morning, and you open the newspaper, and you see 7, 8, 5, 3, 2. Oh my goodness, that's the number. That's the lottery. Oh my goodness, I won $100 million. Wow! Who felt joy? Who felt that ecstasy of wow, I won? It wasn't your arms, it wasn't your chest, it wasn't your legs. If your arms were paralyzed, if you were locked into a chair, you would still feel the joy. You see, that's an example where I feel something, but it's not my body. And it's not even through my body. The highest experiences, the most pleasurable and the most painful experiences that we human beings have don't come through us through the body. Oh, I eat a steak and potato and it tastes good, but that's muffled. When you feel tremendous joy, it's not through the body. When you meet your child for the first time in the delivery room and there's just an inexplainable sense of joy, it didn't come to you through your body. It's not that your arm felt happy. It's not that your chest felt joy. I, the one inside, I, the occupant of this body, felt tremendous joy. And the opposite. You ever say one of those lines that as you said it, you said, oh my goodness, I don't believe those words came out of my mouth. I want to crawl into a hole in the ground. And you feel a searing pain. You said the most embarrassing line you ever can imagine. And you just want to crawl into a hole in the ground. Now, who felt it? Was it your arms, your chest? Did your forehead feel it? Oh, your face got flushed. But I felt the pain. I felt the pain of embarrassment. When I leave this body behind, I separate with all of my sensations, with all of my feelings. I acutely feel tremendous joy. I acutely feel tremendous pain, but it's I, the occupant of the body. The body is buried. I, the guy inside, live on forever. And this concept, while it may seem simple, is not simple at all. It may seem obvious, but it's not at all obvious. And let me share with you what I mean. One of the great challenges today in medical ethics is defining death. How do you define death? Is it when the heart stops? Is it when there's no brainstem activity, no self-breathing? How do you define the moment of death? Now, I'd like to tell you it's very simple. Simple as pie. I am the occupant of the body. When I leave this body, I'm dead, finished. It's as simple as pie. What's difficult? All you have to do is measure. When I leave, I'm dead. Why is there great issues? Why are there great questions? I'd like to share with you why there's so many issues. You see, physical science is very skilled at measuring physical properties. How long, how dense, how heavy, how tall. Physical properties are measurable in inches and pounds and various things. But how do you measure I? Do you put I into a beaker and add blue dye and see what color it turns? Do you put I on a scale? Imagine for a minute someone walks into into a Home Depot and says, gentlemen, I need a pound of light. Can I have a pound of light? And the fellow behind the counter says, what? I need a pound. You know, my dining room is about 18 feet by 20 feet. I figure about a pound of light is enough to light it up. Can I have a pound of light? And the guy behind the counter would look a little askance. What do you mean a pound of light? Luminosity is a measure of light. Candle power is a way of determining how much light it offers. But you can't weigh a pound of light. And so too, you can't measure I with physical dimensions because I don't exist in a physical plane. Let me say that again. I, the guy inside, I, the one speaking to you, do not exist in a physical realm. You can't weigh me, you can't measure me because I'm not physical. I'm alive, I'm very much alive. I was this morning and I hope to be tomorrow morning as well. But I, the one inside, am utterly, totally not physical. I'm the spiritual element, I'm the occupant of the body, but I don't exist in a physical realm. And the reason why science has such difficulty defining death is because I don't exist in the entire system that they measure. You can't weigh me, you can't see how long I am, because in that dimension, in that realm, I don't exist. Now, isn't that strange? I sure do exist because I know I exist, but yet in a physical plane, I don't exist. And this concept is tremendous. This concept is one of the deepest ideas that a human being can ever come to. You see, one of the most fundamental mistakes that we typically make is we think of ourselves as physical beings. Listen, I'm a physical being. Occasionally, I'll have a spiritual experience. Maybe on Shabbos, I don't know, maybe on Yom Kippur. I'm a physical being who occasionally has spiritual experiences. Nothing could be further from the truth. I am a spiritual being who temporarily is having a physical experience. I'm not the body, I'm not the arms, I'm not the legs, I'm not the chest. I'm the guy inside. I feel, I am alert, I am alive, but I'm not physical. And as strange as it sounds, we make the biggest mistake. We think of ourselves as physical beings. We think of ourselves as I'm a body, I'm a physical guy, and it's utterly, completely false. I'm the guy inside, I'm the occupant of the body, and I am utterly, totally spiritual. And while normally we don't think in these terms are critical to understanding life. Because only when I understand that can I relate to existing after my body dies. When I say to the guys in my high school class, who cares about what you do here? The reason why that question resonates is because I'll be dead. I won't be there. You know, I'll be not there. I'll be asleep, whatever that means. I'll be my neshama, my alter ego. Understanding that I, the one who feels, I, the one who'm right here, right now, am the one who will be there then, is critical to understanding life, critical to understanding everything we do. Now, usually, when I spend enough time on these types of concepts, and I give enough mashalim, I watch people get that aha moment, as in, ah, I get it. Rabbi, I hear what you're saying. I'm not the arms, I'm not the chest, I'm not the legs, I'm the brain, right? I get it, right? Wrong. Now, I've never been there at an autopsy, but it is my sincere belief that when they bury the body, they bury the brain with it. You see, just as I'm not the arm, the chest, the head, or the leg, I'm also not the brain. And I'd like to share with you a very interesting concept. I think through the brain. You ever get an intuition, a flash, as in, oh, wow. Maybe you're learning a Tosfos, and all of a sudden, something is something. And then you have to sort of think it through the concrete, sluggish thing called the brain. That's an example where I know something intuitively, instinctively, I know it, and then I have to go into my concrete, very sluggish, slow brain to think it through. That's an example of an I moment. You see, I'm not the brain. I'm inside this body, and I have to relate to this world through the conscious mind of my brain. But what happens, Rachman Al-Tzan, you have a tremendous Talmud Chacham, and he becomes elderly, and he begins losing his memory. It's called Alzheimer's, but all of the Torah that he amassed throughout his life is gone. So I want to ask you a very pointed question. When he leaves this earth, his Torah is gone, it's not there. The answer is his brain is damaged. The brain that he's forced to think through is temporarily marred, but he remembers everything. And one of the key understandings of life is that I'm not the body, I'm not the brain, I'm the occupant of the body, and when I leave this physical existence, I remember everything. Every conversation I ever had, every thought that ever crossed my mind makes an indelible impression upon me. I am my thoughts, I am my feelings, I am my emotions, and they are there forever. Temporarily, as long as I'm in this body, I experience something called shikha, forgetting. You have a loss of a loved one. It tends to fade with time. You went through a certain event. Time has its effect and it leaves you. The memory isn't as acute. It's not as much right there. You're no longer in touch with that same sensation because the memory has faded. That's a function of a physical existence. In the world to come, when I leave this body, I leave behind the physical limitations, I leave behind my physical limits, and I leave behind my brain, every memory comes rushing back with total clarity, absolute acuity. I see it, I feel it, with the same level of consciousness, that same tremendous joy, or the same tremendous pain, with a level of absolute, total, clear consciousness. Because the brain is put in the ground, I'm no longer muddled, I'm no longer held back, I now see things with absolute understanding and clarity. And this understanding that I am a spiritual being who's temporarily having a physical existence is key and essential to understanding life. When you understand this, the world to come is very, very relevant. Why? Because it's me. It's not my distant cousin. It's not my alter ego. It's not my neshama. I used to tell the guys in my high school shiur that soul, neshama, is a four-letter word. You're not allowed to use it in shiur. Why? Because neshama has this sort of, oh, my neshama, my soul. I'll do mitzvahs now so my neshama will go to Olam Haba. It's so delusional. Why? Because it allows me to divorce myself from my neshama. And the question I ask those guys then is so penetrating. Who cares about your soul? Who cares about your neshama? Why should you learn? Why should you daven? Why should you do chesed? Why should you work so hard so your neshama, whatever that is, could have a good time there? Says Rabbi Sol Salanta, the answer to that question is, I am the soul. I am the guy inside. I am completely, utterly spiritual. And what I do with my time here affects me. Why does it affect me? Because it shapes me, molds me into what I will be for eternity. Hashem gave us a Torah, Hashem gave us a system of spiritual perfection. Every mitzvah changes me, molds me, shapes me into what I'll be for eternity, but it's me. It's me that will be there, me that will remember, me that will feel very, very powerful, vivid sensations, but it's not my distant cousin, not my alter ego. The body is buried and I live there forever. And again, this is a bit of self-awareness. It really should be obvious but unfortunately it's not. And I'd like to share with you a Musar exercise, a Musar exercise to help make this more vivid, more real, to help be margish it. Imagine the following. Imagine that you're driving. And imagine for a minute that you're not really watching the road very carefully, and you're maybe driving a bit quicker than you should be, and all of a sudden you get a text. A text comes in. Now you're a polite person, and you know the rules of etiquette. The rules of etiquette are you have 30 seconds, no more than that, to respond to a text. Otherwise it's rude. How dare, what do you mean you're in the shower? I don't care. He didn't text me back in 30 seconds. What are you, rude? So you're a polite fellow, and you will respond to texts when text, so you text back. And you get another text, and you respond back, and back and forth, and back and forth, and shattering glass, crash of metal. You wake up in the hospital 3 days later. The doctor looks down on you and says, son, I got some bad news for you. You will never move your legs again. Hey, my legs, hey, help! Now here's the question. Are you alive? Imagine that you literally cannot move a muscle from your waist down again. Are you still alive? Now the answer is obviously yes. Your life now will be quite different. You're going to have to relearn much of what you were doing before, but you, with all of your memories, with all of your sensations, with all of your feelings, are completely alive. Okay? Let's take this same example and ratchet up a level. Same texting, same crash of metal, same hospital bed you wake up in, but when you look up at the doctor, instead of saying you won't move your legs, he looks down and says, son, I have some bad news for you. You will never move another muscle in your body again. And you feel your legs, and they don't move. And you feel your arms, and they don't move. Not your chest, not your head, not your neck. Hey, help, I'm stuck, help, help, I'm stuck in here. And imagine that you wake up in the hospital bed unable to move a single muscle in your body. Now let's even play it out a little bit. Let's imagine that your friends come to visit, and your friends say that which friends say when they don't know what to say. Oy vey, you look terrible. It must be horrible to be there. Thanks a lot, guy. Not bad enough. I gotta be stuck in here. You gotta tell me how bad I look. So here's the question. Are you alive? You hear your friends. You feel the pain. Are you alive? You will never move another muscle in your body again, but are you alive? Now, if you're not sure whether you're alive or not, I'd like to share with you that there's a book called The Butterfly and the Diving Bell that's written about a man who woke up in just such a state. He had been the editor of Elle magazine in France. He was in a similar such car accident, and he woke up in the hospital in a syndrome called locked in. Locked in means he was locked into his body. Couldn't move his arms, couldn't move his legs, and the book chronicles the days, the weeks, the months that he lived in that state. And the book is very compelling. He describes what it was like. He describes what it was like when he heard the news. He describes what it was like when the nurses came to help him. Some of the nurses he described were very caring, very kind. Some were when he called Attila the Hun. I think she flies on a broom at night. He describes what it was like when his children came to visit, how happy he was to see them, but how pained he was that he couldn't touch them. So here's the question. That man, in that state, was he alive or not? So I'd like to share with you quite how alive he was. You see, he was able to move one muscle. He could blink his left eye. A speech pathologist devised a method for him to communicate. She put the alphabet on a card. She would move her fingers down the card. When she got to a letter that he wanted to signal, he would blink his left eye. She would write it down, hence he was able to communicate to the world to express his feelings. If you'd like to know how alive this man was, that book that became a bestseller in France, that was translated into English, was written by that man in that state. In the mornings he would compose the sentences and the paragraphs in his mind. In the afternoon his secretary would stand at the foot of his bed taking dictation letter by painstaking letter, because he died in that state. And if you'd like a mushel, a parable of a man whose body is effectively dead, yet he, totally alive, with all of his memories, with all of his feelings, that book, The Butterfly and the Diving Bell, is an example. But you see, it's an example of this point, that I'm not the body. I'm the occupant of the body. and I'm the guy inside, but don't mistake me for the body. When the body's buried, I live on. And this concept, whilst it's critical, while it's difficult, in our day and age, should be much, much easier than ever before to feel. And I'll explain to you why. In 1979, Raymond Moody caused quite a stir in the scientific community. He wrote a book called Life After Life. He was a physician, and his book chronicled a few hundred cases of a phenomena that was unknown at the time. As a matter of fact, he coined a phrase for this phenomena. He called it near-death experience. Now, we're all familiar now, a few decades after, with a near-death experience. A near-death experience typically is a situation where the patient is dead, either on the hospital table or in a car crash. Typically, there's no respiration, often no heart rate, sometimes even no electrical impulses in the brain. For 2 minutes, 4 minutes, sometimes the patient is dead, and when they're resuscitated, they tell over vivid, graphic details of what occurred when they were dead. And there's an eerie commonality, an eerie similarity between many of the cases. The person describes sort of popping out of his body, sort of hovering in the ceiling and watching as the EMTs are working on his body. He describes seeing things, hearing conversations, knowing certain facts that he couldn't possibly see, couldn't possibly know because he was dead at the time. And yet when he's resuscitated, he tells over graphically, vividly, exactly what occurred. When Raymond Moody published his book, it caused quite a stir because it was unheard of. But in the decades since, thousands upon thousands of cases have been studied and analyzed, scrutinized, and it's become accepted medical fact. Such a state exists. We don't understand it, it doesn't make sense, but it exists. Now, the reason why it doesn't make sense is because from a physical perspective, there's nothing there. All I am anyway is a bunch of cells. I'm just sort of electrical impulses, right? So once the cells are dead, I'm dead. So what can live on? What could see? What could remember? What modern science is beginning to understand is I am but the occupant of the body. You can't weigh me, you can't measure me because I'm spiritual and the body is buried and I live on. And when you read about thousands of such cases and they're corroborated and they're proven and it becomes accepted fact in a scientific community, you begin to realize that little bit of self-awareness that I'm the guy inside. And I'd like to share with you one interesting example. Lancet magazine, which is a prestigious British medical journal, recently ran a study of a few hundred near-death experiences. And I don't want to bore you with the details of the study, but I want to share with you two anecdotes, two stories that are brought in Lancet magazine that illustrate exactly this concept. The first involves a 44-year-old man. The man was, the ambulance arrived at the scene. The man was unconscious. He was effectively dead. They quickly put him in the ambulance. They brought him into the emergency room. And as soon as they got into the emergency room, they wanted to put the paddles on him. The problem is he had dentures. They reached into the mouth, pulled out the dentures, put the paddles on him, tried once, tried twice, finally got back a pulse, and the man survived. Okay. A little while later, he's beginning to recover, and he asks one of the nurses on duty for his dentures. Could you please find my dentures? The nurse looks here, she looks there, can't find them. He asks another nurse, could you find my dentures? They look all over, can't find it. Day after day, no one could find the dentures. Finally, after a week that he's in the hospital, the nurse who was on duty when he was brought into the emergency room, who had been on vacation the past week, came back. And he turns to her and he says, wait a minute, you were the nurse on duty. Don't you remember? You took out my dentures and you put it in the top drawer of that cart, the cart with the wheels on it. Don't you remember? She said, oh, wait, you're right. She went to look for that cart and opened the top drawer and pulled out his dentures. Fine. Except for one problem. When she pulled the dentures out of his mouth, he was blue in the face, stone dead. He was on the operating table before they put the paddles on him. No pulse, no respiration. You could have screamed at him, you could have yelled at him. He was stone dead. Yet he recalled vividly the details. It was in the drawer, the top drawer. You put my dentures there. Let's try one more story. Again, brought in Lancet magazine, a prestigious medical journal. Second story is about a 36-year-old woman who suffered an aneurysm, bleeding in the brain. Normal procedure requires opening the skull and cauterizing the area. Typically what they'll do is they'll sear, take a hot probe, and burn the surrounding tissue that stops the bleeding. Sew it back up, send her home, everyone's fine and well. The problem was that the bleeding in her case was so deep in her brain that had they gone into corduroys, they would have caused so much residual bleeding that she would have bled to death. The surgeon said to her, "Madam, I'm sorry to tell you this, but there's nothing we can do for you." Effectively, they sent her home to die. There was one surgeon who had discovered a theoretical solution. He said to her, "Madam, I've never tried it before, but I've thought about it for a while. There is a procedure that's called standstill. Basically, it means we put you under anesthetic, we drain all of the blood from your brain, the surgeon goes in, opens your scalp, cauterizes the area, closes you back up, and then we put the blood back in. If there's no blood in your brain, obviously you can't bleed. If the surgeon works quickly enough, in theory, we could save your life." Now, there was no alternative. She consulted with many other medical professionals. She consulted with a clergy. She decided to undergo the procedure. But here was the problem. There could be no bleeding. The day of the operation, they put tape over her eyes, put special monitors in her ear. They put her body in a bath of ice. They put her under anesthetic, lowered her core temperature as low as they could possibly get it. They drained all of the blood from her head. The surgeon went in, opened her scalp, found the region of the bleeding, cauterized it. He sealed it back up, closed the scalp. They put the blood back into her, took her body out of the bath of ice, and took her out from under anesthetic. Astonishingly, she survived. As she's recuperating, the surgeon comes in to visit her to see how she's doing. And when the surgeon walks in, she begins laughing. "Doctor, doctor, I must share with you. When you were operating me, I had the strangest hallucination. I envisioned that I popped out of my body. I popped out of my body and I was hovering by the ceiling. And I was watching. I was watching while you were operating. And you took this electric toothbrush. You took this electric toothbrush and you tried to put it into a vein in my thigh. And it didn't fit. So you turned to the nurse next to you and you said, 'It doesn't fit.' She said, 'Try again.' You tried a second time and you said, 'It doesn't fit.' She said, 'Try again.' So you tried a third time and it fit." "Doctor, isn't that funny?" The doctor didn't laugh. The doctor turned white. Because part of the procedure involved taking a medical instrument from a distance, could look like a electric toothbrush. He had to put it into a vein in her thigh, but the vein was occluded. It was too small. He tried to put it in and it wouldn't fit. He turned to the surgical nurse next to him and he said, "It doesn't fit." She said, "Try again." He tried a second time. He said, "It doesn't fit." She said, "Try again." He tried a third time and it fit. But that conversation between doctor and nurse was held while this woman's body was in a bath of ice. She was stone dead. She was not present. You could have screamed at her. You could have yelled at her. She wasn't there. But she recalled vividly the details of the conversation. And when you read about hundreds, thousands of such cases, you begin to get it. I'm not the body. I'm the occupant of the body. When I leave, forever I am what I shape myself into. Then, for the first time, the world to come is relevant because it's me and it's real. I'm not the physical body that I think I am. I'm the guy inside. The body's buried and forever I am what I shape myself into. What the Mesillas Yesharim is teaching us is the world to come is the spa. This is the gym. I'm given a few short years here to grow, to accomplish. The challenges of life are exactly that, opportunities to shape myself. But when I'm done my work here, I leave and forever it's me. I'm there. Whatever I shape myself into is what I am for eternity.